Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
Welcome to Yin Radio. Today's show is called Get Out. Get out can mean a lot of things. You might simply be telling someone to go outside and play, like Mom used to tell us. Or you're telling someone something more than that. Move out, perhaps. You're old news. Or the job's over. Or out yourself. Live life openly. Openly gay. Openly pagan. Openly non-mainstream. Openly you. Or you might be simply meaning that, no way, just get out, you're kidding. Today I'm going to bring you a number of stories that interpret the phrase, get out. And we're going to see what getting out means to different people. I'm Sandy Billings, and from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, featuring women's voices and women's stories. Today's show is called Get Out.
Let's go outside.
We get going outside in installment number one. When Courtney Rush gets outside, she finds God. This is Courtney's story of God and the environment, her two greatest passions.
The bottom line is the times that I've been in outdoor situations and been experiencing the outdoors, I always feel the presence of God there. And being outdoors, I think, draws me nearer to God. And so then, since both living for God and being outdoors are my passions, it was so neat that the two of them were so strong when coupled together. And I've just learned a lot about my belief in God and how His creation is not separate from Him.
Courtney is an environmentalist. She studied natural resources and conservation biology in college. And when she finished her degree, she went to work for the Palouse Clearwater Environmental Institute. Court runs the volunteer program, and there couldn't be a better person to do the job. She's upbeat, energetic, passionate about her work, and able to talk to anyone with interest in their goals and abilities. Not a feigned interest, but a look you in the eye, slow down and pay attention because what you think matters kind of interest. And with that kind of interest, she can match anyone up with the right volunteer task. And if you're not sure that you want to volunteer, hang around Court for a while, and you'll discover her enthusiasm has rubbed off on you, too. As for her own personal interests, when she looked herself in the eye and paid attention, she saw that the environmental part of her was being met at work, but she wasn't seeing religious people contributing time and effort to environmental causes. So she decided to reach out to churches.
With my course of study in college, I was in restoration. I was in natural resources and conservation biology. And through being able to work at PCEI, it was almost like I got my network of people who were interested in that environmental sector. And most of our volunteers do not come from a faith-based mindset. Most of our volunteers come with environmental mindset first. That's why they're here. And I was noticing that not very many people of faith are in our community are reaching out for the environment, and I know they would want to if they knew about the opportunities, or at least if somebody told them, hey, have you ever thought about how important it is to be caring for our environment? And so with that, as I started thinking about that, then I set my goals for this year being to reach out to the church populations of the community and then also the elderly populations of the community, because both were groups that I wasn't seeing volunteer at PCEI. So with that, and with starting to have a goal of reaching out to the churches, that's when I started seeing the churches try to reach back and say, hey, we are interested in that, or that's a huge topic in the church right now. Come and tell us a little bit more about it.
Courtney may have hit on something big. Environmental conservation is a hot topic in Christian churches, she says.
It's actually almost a trendy hot topic in Christian faith right now.
Even so, not all Christians take the same stance as Courtney. The argument that she's heard is that it's God's will that global warming is happening. And if it weren't God's will, he could stop it, and would stop it. If he can't stop it, he's not God. But Courtney doesn't buy it. Instead, it boils down to basics for her.
When Jesus is asked to sum up the Ten Commandments, you know, they're like, okay, basically, what are the rules that we have to follow? And he says, love God and love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've really got to thinking about is, how do we love God?
And that is done by taking care of the earth.
I feel like in protecting the outdoors, not only am I serving God, but I'm also serving the people that I love. And that would include my friends, my future family, you know, anybody that is involved in this world. I think that we all have a part in caring for it and leaving it to be a better place than we received it as.
She says that taking care of God's gift is an expression of love.
God gave us this amazing creation. And even if, you know, even if he said, this is for you to have dominion over, do whatever you want with it, it would be our choice to love him by caring for that gift. And I recognize that other people see it a different way, and I don't see how you could see it any other way.
And on this basis, Courtney has moved forward on her plans to reach out to faith-based groups, not just Christians, but anyone who considers themselves spiritual, to encourage their participation in environmental activities. She first got invited to give a keynote talk at the Faith and Environment Network in Spokane.
It was really flattering because they wrote to PCEI and said, we need a keynote speaker, we're doing Faith and Environment Network, we're talking about why it's important to care for the environment as people of faith, all sorts of different kinds of faith coming together to this conference. You know, is there anyone that could be our keynote speaker? So it got forwarded to me, and I was like thinking about, how do I audition for this, and do I need to turn in a resume? And so I wrote an email back and said, this is who I am, and I'd be really interested in it. And they wrote back and said, yeah, we know who you are. That's why we contacted PCEI. And of course, we want you to do it. So it was like they had already known who I was, and it was through an AmeriCorps connection. So an AmeriCorps member that had heard me just give a talk on volunteerism in McCall, her mom's on the network. And so I guess she had mentioned to her mom that I would be a good speaker for the event. So cool. Yeah, it was totally cool. And then I spoke twice at Christian Life Center, which is CLC. It's a Christian church that is trying to get heavily involved with caring for the environment. And they were doing like a 6-week sermon series on the importance of taking care of our environment.
Courtney's presentation at the CLC was different from a keynote, more of a question and answer session about why the group should care about the environment. Or really, why Courtney cares, her personal story, coupled with an appeal to come out and help with the local stream cleanup on Earth Day. She has another talk scheduled this month in Spokane. She may have found her calling, something she was born to do.
It's something that I've been involved in for a long time. So since basically I was in high school, I've been taking trips with, say, my youth group. So I've been in the outdoors experiencing God with other people. Then my job through college was as a river guide in Colorado for a Christian rafting company, where I could either choose to or choose not to engage in conversation about God in the outdoors. And then, but I had the freedom to talk about with my customers about whatever I wanted. And then most recently, in college, I started a group on campus, and it was called the Wilderness Crew, and it was an offshoot. I was involved with Campus Crusade for Christ, and so this was the Wilderness off-campus Crusade for Christ. And so I've been involved with getting other Christians and other people of faith into the outdoors to know it and to meet the outdoors, you know, and to see that it's worth protecting and that it's such a vital part of who we are. Yeah. And so through all of that, I've always wanted to become more active in talking to people and encouraging people to become involved in caring for our environment.
Courtney has found a way to combine her passions, God, and the environment. Her message is an echo of her experience, which is get out and get God.
The music of the spheres. This is my Father's world. I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, and the wonders wrought.
Women's voices, women's stories on Yin Radio. Today's theme is Get Out. Installment number two is about getting out, way out, into the heart of the wilderness. Author Debbie Lee read this piece at the Silos Coffee Shop in Moscow to a packed room last April 18th. It's a story about searching for her grandmother's story. The search led her to a wilderness cabin where her grandmother had spent a number of years as a young adult, and the search didn't lead where she expected. Because instead of finding her grandmother's story, she found another woman who was trying to get out. To set the scene, Debbie began by telling us how to get to that cabin. We start from Lewiston, Idaho.
I'm driving on Highway 12 for about 2.5 more hours southeast across the Nez Perce Indian Reservation until you come to the confluence of the Clearwater and the Selway River. Then you take a right and you drive 25 miles on this dirt road with huge potholes, which takes about an hour. And then you are at a trailhead called Race Creek, where there's a Forest Service pack station. It's also a trailhead. Then you get out and you get your backpack on and you hike for about 25 or 30 more miles. And you're in the middle of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. You're at a place called Moose Creek Ranger Station, where there is about 6 old log cabin buildings and a barn and 2 airfields, 2 grass backcountry airfields that are each about a mile long. So Moose Creek Ranger Station is the last operating backcountry station in the U.S., and it is in the center of one of the largest tracts of wild land in the United States. It also happens to be the place where my grandparents lived for 20 years, starting in about 1920, before my mother was born. And my grandfather died before I was born, but my grandmother, I was very close with. She was like a second mother to me in many ways. But when she died, I started to find out these things. I never knew she'd lived in this place for 20 years before before my mother was born. And it just seemed very odd to me that it's like, you know, finding out someone you love dearly had a secret life. And then we started to find some documents and some photos and things out, you know, about her life that caused this really conflict in me, because, for example, there was like a photo we found of one of the buildings back at Moose Creek that said on the back of it, Moose Creek Ranger Station, where I spent many miserable years with a man I didn't love and who didn't love me. In her memoir that she left behind, she had all these wonderful memories of going out on the trails and whatever, running phone lines to the lookouts and this and that. And she has a statement at the end of that that says, the last winter I spent at Moose Creek, I had an overwhelming sense of longing to winter there. So there were all these sort of contradictions and puzzles to me. So I am a professor of 18th and early 19th century British literature, but I became obsessed with this story, and not just with her story, but with the larger story of this wilderness area. This part I'm going to read comes from the first visit to the station with my mother. A bush pilot had flown us in. A lot of people backpack were there, but the first time a bush pilot flew us in, and we were camped near the airfield, and we were getting ready to walk up for the first time to the log cabin where Esther, who was my grandmother, had lived. So that's where I'm reading from. When I walked into camp, there was something wrong with my mother. I could tell right away. Her mood was stiff and thick. She does this thing when she gets stressed. She'll sort of wiggle her bra with her forearm as if she's scratching an itch. She's not scratching or fixing her bra. It's some bad feeling that makes her shoulder twitch. Anyway, if you spend a lot of time with her, or if you're her only daughter, you totally recognize this movement and it makes you nervous. She was doing that twitch the next day after lunch when we were getting ready to walk up the airfield to Esther's cabin. But I was the same way. I felt tense and yet jittery with something like excitement. What would I see in there? I mean, would I understand something that would change my idea of her? Maybe I could find something really valuable, an old diary under the floorboards or some photos sewn into the mattress. Or maybe it would be more subtle, the shape of old jars hidden in the basement or a particular pattern in the cloth curtains that hung in her bedroom. I wanted to find some clue to her contradictions, to her happiness and misery, to her connection and disconnection with this place. Let's go, I said to my mother, but she was procrastinating, throwing hot dog buns and marshmallows in a plastic Shopko bag. This made me more nervous, so I sat down in a lawn chair around the blackened embers of the campfire. She kept saying, I've got to get this cleaned up. Just then, this girl appeared in our campsite. She stood there at the very edge like she was afraid to bother us. She was probably in her late teens or early 20s. A rope around her waist held up her khaki shorts. Auburn hair cropped over her ears exposed her hollow cheeks. Can you help me? She said. That's when I noticed her eyes had this hungry, too tired to sleep hardness, like deer scrounging for food in midwinter. My mother stopped working. What do you need? She said to the girl. Do you know the pilot? We know him. Can you tell him I don't need a ride? Sure, but where don't you need a ride to? My mother walked up to the girl and stood with her arms behind her back held at the wrist and her head cocked to one side, a posture that means she's listening intently, not just to your words, but to your feelings. Out of here, the girl said. I was asking the pilot yesterday about catching a ride. I haven't got any money. He said he'd fly me out with you, but I changed my mind. I'm walking out. You're in the middle of the wilderness, my mother said. I was still seated and gawking at the woman. You should have seen her legs. Her knees were a total mess, scratched and scabbed and indecently bony. Are you sure you can make it? My mom said. I have to. The girl's voice faltered. Tell him I don't need a ride. Wait, what's your name? My mother said. Emma. Her eyes widened and she looked like she was on the verge of a breakdown. And then it just got really quiet, except the sound of the cellway crashing on the boulders and some bird making that peep peep sound. The trees behind my mother started to quiver and I squinted. I saw a bushy bearded man in the shade of a Douglas fir. He was staring at my mother like he was a serial killer or something. Emma started whimpering. She was so long and angular and spooky looking. I thought it was kind of weird that my mom would want to touch her. But she did. She put her arm around Emma and said, "My God, what's wrong?" The bearded man tried to disappear behind the fir trunk, but I could see his trouser hems and hiking boots. Emma said, "I've been hiking for 3 months." "Alone?" "No, I'm with my boyfriend. We've been planning it for a year, and I can't go on." She started heaving now, like she was about to vomit, but I realized it was a deep sobbing noise. I had to hand it to my mother. I mean, here she was, getting to walk up the airfield to Esther's old cabin. And she forgot it all and focused everything on this falling apart girl. That's how my mother is. She has this amazing presence of mind. She wrapped her arms around Emma and patted her back. Then she whispered, "How much weight have you lost?" Emma stepped back and untied her rope belt and pulled her pants away from her stomach. Her hip bones protruded from her concave belly, and a good 3 or 4 inches of fabric stretched beyond her waist. "These pants were tied on me when I left." "How far have you come in 3 months?" my mother asked. 600 miles, and it's another 600. To hike the Centennial Trail has been our dream, and I am so tired." 600 miles? I turned the figure over in my mind, trying to imagine it. I knew about the Centennial Trail, the route that she was following. It's a 1,200-mile grind through the entire state of Idaho that traverses some of the most rugged terrain in the country. Starting at the Nevada border and carrying a 40-pound pack, she would have hiked 3,400 feet down to the Snake River Canyon, then climbed to 9,500 feet in the Sawtooth Mountains. She would have descended and climbed again and again for hundreds of miles through landscape that changes from high desert shrub steppe to low dry hills, then old burns, high alpine meadows, huckleberry hillsides, and glacier-fed lakes. She probably came face to face with bighorn sheep and mountain goats and ospreys and harlequin ducks and elk and otters and moose and martens and coyotes and bears. "You should feel proud of yourself for making it this far," my mother said to her. "But to hike the whole trail has been our dream," she started to sob again. "Is it his dream or yours?" my mother said. Emma cupped her head in her hands. Then my mother's voice grew really serious and low. "Your trip can end here. If he's any kind of man, he'll understand that you need to get some food. You need some sleep." She took Emma by the arm and led her to our picnic table. "You need some chocolate." She placed 4 Hershey bars in Emma's hand, and then Emma turned and walked away. Thank you for your help. Tell the pilot thank you." "Anyway," we could hear her saying. I looked for the dark bearded man, but he was gone. "Shouldn't we do something?" I said. "There's nothing we can do," my mother shrugged her shoulders. She went back to organizing the campsite, shoving paper plates into garbage bags hanging from a pine, and then sliding into the forest shade where Emma's boyfriend had just been standing. When she returned, she sat in the lawn chair next to me. "Will she be able to walk out of here?" I said. "Who knows, but I doubt it, because when I hugged her, it was just like hugging a skeleton. She has nothing left."
That was Debbie Lee reading from her story that I call Searching in the Wilderness. The next 2 installments are about getting out by coming out, announcing your identity as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender person. For the University of Idaho's Talk About It project, LGBT folks from the university and community shared their coming out stories. It's all part of National Coming Out Day. Rebecca Rod is the GLBT program advisor at the UI Women's Center. She describes an early experience while attending college in the 1970s.
My freshman year at the Lutheran College I attended in my hometown, I met a girl named Linda, a friend of a friend of my friend that I really didn't like. She was sweet and bubbly, and her shoulder-length red hair bounced around when she walked. I was more moody and reserved, given to writing serious poetry and smoking cigarettes. But when she found out that we were both English majors, she somehow pulled me into a friendship with her strange, sunny disposition. Then I began to notice when I was with her, I felt a kind of energy in the air, like sparks and the force of magnets working overtime. In fact, whenever we'd take a walk together, we'd constantly bump against each other, and just this accidental contact between us seemed to leave a radiating space on my body wherever we touched. This was new to me. Even though I'd had the usual physical contact with the high school boys I'd dated, this was different, more like exquisite. Well, it turned out to be mutual, and soon we were begun, so to speak. It was pretty wonderful for a few months. Then it turned out there was a worm in the apple. She was a Baptist, and the guilt of our loving started to eat away at her, and I was Lutheran after all, so pretty soon she had me praying with her that we would not do this anymore and just be friends. But it never worked, so she broke our relationship off after a few short months. My heart was broken and my spirit was crushed, and I became a cynic about love. I was angry and confused at God for coming between me and my beloved. After all, if God was love, how could loving be a sin? And if you are a religious or spiritual person at all, finding yourself in this situation, you realize that you have a devil of a choice to make: God or love. In my mind, this is where the really crushing spiritual damage is done. For people who have grown up with God in their lives, who love God and have been told over and over again that God loves them, coming to this desperate point stunts the blossoming of a spiritual life just like that. So I just stopped going to church and packed the pain of all of it away from me. Yet practically daily, I prayed to the God I didn't believe in anymore to please just make me be normal. I dated guys for a while again, hoping something might take, I guess. Nothing did. And so I began my stumbling journey of hide and seek with love. Only it was more like seek and hide, in the sense that I was secretly seeking love, wanting it so badly, I knew if I found it, I'd have to keep it hidden. Then in my senior year of college, I met another Linda and fell off the wagon and in love again. The critical thing about this second relationship was that it made me begin to think that there just might be a pattern forming here in my life, like I could be, gulp, a lesbian. Linda and I actually talked about our relationship sometimes in rather nebulous terms, but we pretty much decided that we weren't really lesbians, that we were just in love with each other. After all, we both had had more relationships with guys than with girls. And so comforted, we went on happily for some time. But as my feelings for her grew, I felt at a loss for words to express the depth of them, being limited by the vaguely defined relationship we had. I can remember the day when I tried best I knew how. I just told her I felt like I wanted to marry her, even though I knew I wasn't entitled to use that label. I remember feeling so relieved when she didn't turn away in horror or laugh at me. Eventually, we moved to the liberal hotbed of Iowa City, where we found a whole bunch of women like us. That was pretty amazing. And this is where the label that was so scary and to be avoided at all costs became a label of love and belonging and healing. We were lesbians now, in the company of other women like us. Finding and being in community with people who accept you is definitely a salve for the pain of separation and alienation that many of us feel. Things went along pretty well for us for a while, until Linda's mother figured us out. She came barreling down to Iowa City in her car to pay us a visit, during which she screamed at us the whole time, blamed me for corrupting her daughter, and said, "If I had a gun, I'd shoot you both." And then she left. The violence of that encounter was pretty stunning. Not long after that, we broke up again. This devastated me so badly that I couldn't hide it, and that's when I started my coming out process with my family, which is another story.
This is Yin Radio, featuring women's voices and women's stories. This week's show is called Get Out, and right now we're listening to coming out stories. Installment number 4, Liz Brandt, law faculty and associate dean at the University of Idaho, shares her story of coming out. It's her story, but it's about her son. Liz has been an activist for years, supporting gay rights, women's rights, full inclusion, and human rights for all. She thought she couldn't be closer to the issue of gay rights than she already was, especially after the Idaho amendment to ban same-sex marriage snuck up on us and passed. But then her son came out as gay, and her perspective changed.
Last fall, my son Christian told me and his father that he was gay. At the time, he was in Denmark in the first part of a year-long exchange for his junior year in high school. He sent us an email. In the email, he said he had known he was gay for some time, and he meant to tell us before he left for Denmark, but he just never found the right moment. This email announcement really affected me. I'd never thought about whether Christian was gay. In retrospect, there were many clues. His absolute refusal to go to dances at school and total lack of interest in girls, even as a high school freshman and sophomore, were a couple of them. When he told me, however, I had the sense of total understanding. Things about Christian just clicked into place. Both his father and I thought, of course, how could we have not known this detail about him? My feelings about Christian's email were mixed up and emotional. On the one hand, I'm very grateful that Christian was able and comfortable enough with himself to understand his orientation, and grateful that he will not have to go through some long period of doubt, secrecy, or self-loathing. Yet he's my baby, and he was across the ocean. I couldn't look in his eyes and assure myself that his core identity was still strong and intact. I now have looked in his eyes and hugged him and know that he's okay. However, I still worry about him. I know being a gay man will not always be easy, and that he will encounter hate and misunderstanding. I know that my brilliant, beautiful son will not always be valued for his skills and talents, but will sometimes be dismissed because of who he is. Christian's hesitation to tell his father and me that he is gay has caused me to reflect on how much courage coming out requires. Some who read this may not know that my husband and I have been committed activists in the cause of LGBT civil rights for many years. We have marched in parades, volunteered to be plaintiffs in lawsuits, and have written and spoken in support of LGBT rights. Our extended families are also very supportive. Christian's aunt and her partner have been together longer than his father and I have been married. I know that some of Christian's hesitation to talk to us was just parent-kid stuff. It's hard to talk about intimate matters that have sexual overtones with your parents. But I also know that even in our supportive family, Christian worried that somehow his relationship with us would change because he came out. My son Christian is gay. But what you really need to know is that he is a brilliant young man who cares about others, wants to study cultural anthropology. He plays the cello, the ukulele, and the piano, and he loves theater. He speaks Spanish and Danish. I'm very proud of him, and I love him with all my heart.
Reading the story evoked emotions that were closer to the surface than Liz had realized. She spent some time after the reading to talk to me about those emotions.
Well, it was just so hard to be so far away when he told me. So reading it just makes me think about how worried I was that I couldn't talk to him. And, you know, I couldn't talk to him about the sex thing. I was really worried that he would be, you know, he was over in Denmark and that he would be experimenting and that he might not be safe. And, you know, so I, you know, kids experiment with sex, but I just think it's a lot more dangerous for gay kids than it is for straight kids when they experiment with sex. And I worried that just that he maybe was a little lost about it, and that's why he hadn't told us. It breaks my heart to think that he's going to encounter barriers, and I worry a lot about it. He's kind of grown up in this wonderful, safe community. The high school here is very supportive of kids, and he has, I think, never really encountered any discrimination. Other people have paved the way in his family, and so it's just sort of was like, oh, yeah, okay, to his grandparents and his cousins and stuff. And his friends here were pretty accepting. They knew long before I did. I guess he's been out to them since he was in junior high. So, you know, they didn't care. And my daughter just couldn't, his twin sister just couldn't believe we didn't know. But I, you know, you don't think about your kid in that way. And so I just didn't.
I asked her, as a mother, what do you worry about?
I really worry about him leaving this safe place where he's been loved and honored for who he is. And I worry maybe he doesn't have the tools to deal with, you know, things that might happen to him. And, you know, how will he be able to handle them? And, you know, he's one of those kids who just doesn't get that everybody wouldn't just love you right off the face of the map, you know, that it would just be the automatic thing that you would do. And so I really, you know, I just think you worry about your kids and you want their way to be smooth.
She probably knows as a mom and, of course, as an activist that the barriers are out there.
You do. You know, I, for all of my lefty leanings, I'm a really pretty conventional person. And my husband and I, we have a pretty conventional life that we love. And I want Christian to have that too. And I guess that's the other thing that makes me really emotional, because I think the barriers on gay marriage and stuff, I wonder, I want him to have a life partner who is as wonderful as my husband. We've been married for more than 20 years, and it's, you know, I can't imagine life without him. And I want that for my son. And I think that, you know, it's hard enough to have long-term, stable, intimate relationships when you're when you're just to have the mainstream ones and everything's set up to support who you are. You know, to sustain those kinds of long-term relationships over all the bumps and pushes and shoves that are going to come when you're not in the mainstream, that's even harder. And so I really worry about that. And I want him to enjoy being a father. And I wonder how will that be able to happen for him? And will he be able to find a way to make it happen, to be a parent and a father? That's been really an important part of our life. And I think it's something he envisions for himself too, that family thing. I don't think, you know, I don't see anything about him that is a, you know, who knows? He's just starting college. Who knows where I'll end up? But I want him to be able to have those things that he wants. And, you know, so I worry a lot. I don't want him to have to be a plaintiff in lawsuits or be a poster child for things. You know, I have a sister who is a paraplegic, and she spent her whole life being the first paraplegic at her college and being the first this and the first that, and being the one who's always telling them that you can't get a wheelchair into the restroom and the curb cut is broken down and she can't cross the street. And you know, I admire her, but I wouldn't ask for that for people. You know, and I think that's kind of, in some ways, Christian's not going to be the first. There are generations of people who have had to have a lot more courage and have broken through. But still, I think, you know, he's still, you know, of an age where, you know, we're so unaccepting of LGBT lifestyles and people that, you know, he's still going to be paving the way. We still don't, you know, there isn't a normal there. And I guess I find that to be kind of a scary thing.
Being in the mainstream, being normal, is comfortable.
It is comfortable. I'm there and I recognize how comfortable it is. You know, there's a real privilege of being inside that normal envelope. And, you know, I guess I honor that privilege all the time. I know it's there. I enjoy it. I enjoy white privilege and straight privilege. And, you know, it. And I guess it's maybe selfish, but I want my son to have that too. And he's not going to. And that's a really scary thing for me, you know. So I read this statement I wrote, and just kind of brings to the fore all those fears that you have buried as a parent.
Liz Brandt's son plays the cello, the ukulele, and the piano. He loves the theater and studies cultural anthropology. He's a brilliant and caring man. He has a mother who loves him and worries about him, as mothers will and do and should. Liz's worries are compounded by her knowledge and experience as an advocate of human rights, so she knows how hard it can be for someone who's not in the mainstream, like her son, Christian, who is gay. This next brief musical interlude is performed by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Our last installment number 5, is about a very ordinary way to get out in your backyard, in your garden. Now that gardens are being put to bed for the winter, let's reminisce about gardens and especially about decorating them. I spoke with master gardener, teacher, and writer Pat Kesa by phone this fall. You were giving me some background before we started about how you've been teaching before you were doing the writing, or at least as you developed that. Did you start teaching just because you knew that you loved gardening, and how did that evolution come, you know, happen?
Yeah, I think a step at a time. I have always enjoyed writing, always. It's just one way of sharing information. And then I've always enjoyed gardening. And I moved from Northern California to Washington State, and I could not find the summer in the Seattle area. It just seemed like it rained all the time, and I didn't know when to plant my watermelons. So I decided to take the Master Gardener course that was offered through Washington State University, and that's a course where they teach you everything you ever wanted to know, and then some, about gardening. And in repayment for all of that information that they share with you, they ask you to volunteer a certain number of hours a year sharing what you've learned with other people. So essentially that's how I learned to garden in Seattle. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to share with others. So that's how I got into teaching. And also have been tapped to write in a number of columns and articles for a number of gardening magazines. So that's essentially where I am now. And I don't know what I like best, whether it's gardening or writing or teaching. But I think I'm very fortunate to be able to do all three and make a living and share the knowledge and work in the dirt.
Working in the dirt is cool.
Yes, it is. Very, very nice.
Did you have a profession other than gardening before you started moving in the gardening arena?
No, I was a stay-at-home mom, and that's a whole other concept there. It's something that I chose to do. We made a lot of financial sacrifices. So one of my hobbies then was gardening. That's how I spent the afternoons when the kids were in school. And so it just tends to kind of snowball, and I think you spend more time doing what you love or find time to do those things.
And you cover all aspects of gardening in your articles that you write now.
Yes, I do, and that comes from the training through Washington State University. And again, there were certain topics that I enjoyed when I was learning. Insects is one of them. In fact, at my home, you're quite likely to find film cases filled with insects in my freezer because I want to look at them under a microscope. And the best way for me to do that without the eek factor is if they're not moving. Quite an interesting career I have.
Yeah, I don't think too many people have insects in their freezer.
That's right. Well, they're in little film canisters, so they're not really walking around in there.
Still, that can be a little surprising if somebody comes in and a guest starts rummaging around.
Right, exactly. Well, I try to warn people, and certainly I warn my family.
And why freeze rather than a different kind of mounting or, you know, the old bug box formaldehyde?
Well, I had a really bad experience. I was making a collection for Washington State University, and we were shown how to use a bottle and a cotton swab and the chemicals. And I did that. I left the insect in there for the prescribed amount of time. Then I took him out and I mounted him. And I was really proud of the way that I had done that. I thought it was very professional. The next day, the insect had moved. And that cured me from trying to use the chemicals to put them to sleep, more or less.
Now, the recent article that prompted me to give you a call was about, it was in National Gardening, and it was about lawn ornaments.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, you had a picture of a rather small Buddha.
Yes.
He had his hands over his head, and he's hiding under some low leafy border plant.
Uh-huh.
He was very cute.
Those are hostas. They grow really well in Western Washington, and I thought he looked just perfect. His size as compared to the foliage of the hostas, I thought was very complimentary.
Do you have any personal ornament preferences?
To be honest with you, I like flamingos. You know, pink flamingos.
I'm from Florida. I do know pink flamingos.
Well, I think they're tastefully tacky. And I have some dear friends who give me pink flamingos that they run across periodically. I have one that's metal that's probably 2.5 feet tall. And because it's a pale pink, it looks really nice against the hostas, which are kind of a pale green. But if I put every flamingo that they had given me out in my yard, I'd probably be run out of the neighborhood.
You'd have a regular old flock of flamingos.
Exactly, exactly. Which reminds me, if you don't mind going off the topic a little bit, we live near the waterfront, and there's a gentleman who also has a collection of flamingos. And he tends to move them around in his yard, so it looks as though the whole flock is migrating. It's really fun to drive by and see where they might be.
I've also heard of neighborhoods doing that, where the flock will move from one neighbor's yard, and it's like, don't go on vacation, or the flock's going to move into your yard.
What a great idea. I think as long as everyone shares the same sense of humor, I think that's a great idea.
What's some of the most unusual things you've seen or either used yourself that are really outside the box?
Oh, there are so many things that I've seen and actually used because I plant in almost anything that will hold soil and has adequate drainage. So, you know, a little child's pickup truck or tricycle, I've used those as well. I've seen people plant on the roofs of dog houses. You know, they'll start some moss and maybe a few little cascading flowers, and it obviously is dual purpose, but it kind of makes you look twice in that direction, and I think that's what lawn ornaments are all about. Gives you a place to focus and maybe to think a little bit about what you're seeing or why in the world someone would put that in there. But I've seen an herb bed actually made on a bed frame in someone's front yard, and that would be an old spring mattress, so the springs are exposed, and then the metal head and footboard, and they somehow put sphagnum moss in there, and then some potting soil, and they were growing herbs in it, and that was their herb bed.
That's cute.
It is, yeah.
I have actually seen something similar. It was a flower bed.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, and it just was bordered with an old iron bed frame.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, very cute.
Well, so just let your imagination be your guide. I think you're all right.
Tell me a little bit about care, especially you're in Seattle. Of course, you know the whole Northwest region pretty well. We get some freezes, and I don't know what other weather factors may be out there, maybe just general exposure for some ornaments. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about care of lawn ornaments?
Okay, well, in the Seattle area, we don't necessarily get a lot of snow. It can get cold, but we don't have the hard freezes that you might have in the eastern part of the state. So anything that is made of terracotta, which is a clay, or made of glass should probably be taken at least into a garage where it won't freeze. I do have some bird baths that I am careful to empty and take into the garage, usually in December, because our winter is typically January, February. Most anything else can stay out. In fact, it looks better when it's weathered, I think. So if it's metal and it begins to rust, that I think adds character to it. If it's wood and it gets cold and wet and it starts to split, I think that adds some character as well. So really, if it's glass or if it's unfinished concrete or terracotta, I would probably take it in for the winter months. But other than that, I think things should be all right outside in the garden, even in the snow.
So I don't know when you do master gardening, if you get really involved just in your region, or if you get to learn a little bit about how it works throughout the country.
Okay, well, typically the master gardener training is through the local university. So Washington State University does the entire state of Washington. Oregon State University would talk mostly about Oregon. But because our growing areas are similar, most of the training is the same. If you were to move to Tennessee, then the local state university would probably talk about longer summers and shorter winters than they would in Washington State. It's an excellent training program, so anyone who is even remotely interested in gardening really should contact either your local cooperative extension office, and there will be one in every county.
Great. It sounds like it's incredibly valuable, too, as you move from region to region, at least if nothing else, to have a Pat Casa who writes in National Gardening for the region so that you can learn your own region.
Sure.
I moved here from Florida, and, yeah, it's so different. But actually, the interesting thing to me is that I found gardening much more appealing here with the short season. And it's something about how everything pops up and comes to life.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, sure, Florida has its rhythms, but they're so much more subtle.
Yes.
That it just kind of seems constant.
You know, it's interesting. It's that way in Hawaii as well. And I'm with you. I really enjoy seeing all four seasons and anticipating things beginning to grow in the spring, and also in the fall when things begin to wind down. That's also something I look forward to. So I suppose every area has you know, the wonderful plants that you can only grow in that particular region. But I think gardening, when you get right down to digging in the soil, gardening is the same for everyone, almost everywhere.
Sounds a little bit spiritual even.
Well, it is. I can't tell you how many weeds I've pulled when I've been angry, or how many little flowers I've deadheaded to nurture them and to hope that they'll reward me with even more blossoms. So, yeah, I think it is spiritual, or at least it's good for the soul. If nothing else, if we can convince people to go out and enjoy nature, to dig in the soil, which is good for the soul, to plant a few flowers so that insects and birds can visit your yard, I think that that in itself is a lot of reward, and it's worth getting up in the morning.
Thank you very much, Pat Case. I appreciate you spending some time with me and sharing your love of gardening.
Well, it's been a delight, and I'm just really pleased that I was invited to share the time with you.
Pulling weeds and picking stones, man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, cause the time is close at hand. Rain for grain, sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. Tune my body and my brain to the music from the
Well, there is one more interpretation of Get Out that we didn't cover, but this song's going to take care of it for us. It's about leaving, about getting the heck out. The song is Leaving You, and it's by Sharakashka. I'm going to leave you with it. For this Yin Radio Show. I'd like to thank Courtney Rush, Debbie Lee, Liz Brandt, Rebecca Rod, and Pat Casa for today's show. The coming out stories and the gardening piece were edited by Anna Maria Rook and myself. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.